Hi, my name is Hillary Chester. I'm the Associate Director for Anti-Trafficking Programs here at the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops. We house our anti-trafficking work in our Office of Migration and Refugee Services, where we also work doing refugee resettlement work. We work with asylum seekers, unaccompanied migrant children who've arrived in the U.S. by themselves, as well as unaccompanied refugee minor children, and some detained migrants in immigration detention settings. I've been working with victims of human trafficking both directly and indirectly through administering national programs for about 10 years now. I'll be honest and say that I've never been a direct residential service provider, but I have worked alongside those providers and really relied on those partners for shelter and supportive housing for clients that I've been serving both directly and again through a national program. Most of the needs of foreign national victims are very similar to what you would expect and what you may have already experienced serving U.S. citizen and domestic victims and vice versa. It is true that there are some differences, and part of that has to do with the definition of human trafficking here in the U.S. and a lot of state laws, which has resulted in more of the domestic population coming through sexual exploitation, commercial sexual exploitation. And so we do see that there's a kind of a greater range of the kinds of victimization that the foreign national victims experience, and they tend to be exploited in a wider array of industries than U.S. citizen victims do. As a result, there's a lot more labor trafficking victims in the foreign national population. And we see that in some of the programs that we've administered and that other people have administered, that can be as different as 70% victims of labor trafficking, 30% victims of sex trafficking, which is quite different than you would see in a U.S. citizen-based program. One of the things that I will say, having worked a lot with labor trafficking victims in particular, is that while we can certainly imagine how degrading and how traumatic sexual exploitation is and how, just how damaging it is for people to be forced and compelled into those kinds of situations and forms of exploitation, labor trafficking can also be very brutal. There's a lot of the degradation, the psychological humiliation, as well as physical abuse, the use of shame, the concept of someone being ruined and not able to return, for example, to their family or to their community. That kind of control and those coercive methods are certainly common in labor trafficking and can really result in the same degree of trauma that we see in sex trafficking victims, and sometimes even with men, that there can be sexual harassment, sexual abuse of men in labor situations as a way of really breaking down people, breaking down their will, breaking down their sense of power and autonomy. We also see that there can be some untreated physical illnesses or injuries, and can have some real long-term debilitating impacts on the victims and survivors. The psychological coercion that's present can be really severe. People are often isolated and separated from their support networks. They're not able to talk with their family. They're not able to talk with people from their own community. And then we also hear quite a bit from survivors of labor trafficking and just foreign national victims in general that there is this real fear of being arrested and deported, the sense that all of the investment and sacrifice that they made maybe to get to the U.S. and try to make a better start, better opportunity for themselves, the idea that they could just be detained and then sent right back with kind of nothing positive to show for that sacrifice is really a deterrent for them to reach out for help and for them to leave situations, and really just compounds that feeling of powerlessness and that feeling of unable to act and to help themselves. And the damage of that feeling of just powerlessness and helplessness really is traumatizing and can sort of have some residual effects even once they're out of the trafficking situation. We often see cases where, in particular, when a foreign national victim maybe is working in a home of someone, whether it's an extended family member or someone that they didn't have a prior relationship with, if they're in that home, like a nanny or an in-home live-in housekeeper, that they may form attachments, especially to the children, for example, but certainly they can have an emotional bond to a trafficker. we see that in particular in cases of sex trafficking victims as well. The foreign national victims of sex trafficking may also feel that they have a relationship with the trafficker, just like we see in so many of the domestic sex trafficking cases. Often labor trafficking victims are recruited by people from their same community. Sometimes it even is in their own families. Again, that can be similar to the victims of U.S. sex trafficking victims. And so that sense of betrayal, that sense of now not knowing who to trust, the fear of getting their family in trouble if their family was complicit in their trafficking, all of those conflicting emotions that we can see and we hear about with domestic victims is certainly present in many of the labor trafficking cases and cases of foreign national victims more generally. Often there are cases where it's people from the same ethnic community that are exploiting other individuals. And so, again, there's the feeling of that broken trust and that betrayal. And that can be, again, very paralyzing and can just make the recovery process and the sense of how to reintegrate back into their community that has, in a sense, betrayed them more difficult. Another thing that we see among the foreign national victims of trafficking is that they're often really motivated to get back to work. Often they were recruited and enticed and lured into the trafficking situation because they were looking for economic or employment opportunities. Many of them are trying to support families back in their home country. That's their prime motivation, often for coming to the U.S. And so there's this real push, this real drive to get back to work, and that can make the risk of re-exploitation really significant, really high. They will, want to get back into the workforce, and if they don't have the right documentation because their case hasn't progressed far enough along, it puts them really at risk of getting into that shadow economy again. And so the risk of people wanting to leave a program to get back to work is definitely high, and I'll touch back on that again in a moment. So I spoke a little bit about foreign national victims of sex trafficking, and I would say that, again, to highlight the similarities with the domestic cases, if people are more familiar with that, again, that they're often recruited in the same way. We have a lot of cases, a lot of examples where young women in particular are lured with the opportunity of an actual romantic relationship. And so they're groomed in a sense and believe that they are entering into a legitimate relationship with someone. For many of the same reasons that young women and young men fall for those tactics, the foreign national victims as well, that maybe they are not happy in their home life, maybe they just feel really detached or they're not living with their caregivers, their family members that are looking out for them, and they feel adrift, and so they're easily caught up in these romantic schemes. And then we also hear, and this may be a little different than some of the domestic cases, but we hear a lot of families being threatened by the traffickers, and that's one of the key reasons that people will stay in a exploitative situation, because in particular, as I mentioned, if people are coming from the same community, if it's an extended family member that recruited and then trafficked the victim, then they know very well that those traffickers can reach their family in the home community. Sometimes if it's a respected community leader, maybe it's a business leader in a home country community, then they really do have the power and the authority and the resources to do harm to families in the home country. We've been working, for example, with a really large coalition of women who were trafficked from the Philippines to be school teachers. So these are very well-educated women who were working in schools and academic settings in the Philippines, but not being paid well, not given opportunities to advance because there's a lot of local corruption in the Philippines, especially in the rural areas, and some real gender issues that make women much less able to get ahead in the profession. And so many of them took this opportunity. They paid a lot of money to a recruiter to get the job in the U.S., often putting their families' homes and things, getting mortgages, getting loans from you know, what we'd consider loan sharks. And so as a result, their families are now in real financial jeopardy, and they are being threatened by these loan sharks. They are losing homes. And so the threats against the families can be very real, and the traffickers in some cases really can act on those threats. And those are, again, some of the reasons that people not only stay in a trafficking situation, but then once they've been either left the trafficking situation and now you're serving them, for example, really they're very motivated to perhaps leave your programming and get back to work, again, even if it's in the underground economy, just to keep paying back debts that they may owe and to help their families who may be suffering financially in their home countries. There also is that sense of shame, and again, for the example of these school teachers, in some cases the families are very angry with these women for having fallen for the scheme, for having put the family in these very risky, precarious financial situations, and so then the women, these survivors, feel like, you know, I can't go home. My family's very angry at me. Until I can make this right, I can't go home. We hear that from male trafficking victims as well, that knowing that the families have sacrificed financially, or knowing that the family is waiting for them to begin the financial support, if they feel like they can't go home, you know, empty-handed. And so that also it can keep people in an exploitative situation, or put them at risk of looking for other quick fix employment opportunities. So when we do work with foreign national victims of trafficking, we do need to think about, you know, what is their cultural background? What is their, what are they comfortable with that may be different in from a U.S. setting? What may be their expectations about, you know, personal interaction, interpersonal interactions and things. And so there are some considerations that you should have if you're providing housing, which is such an intimate thing, really, for people. And so one of the things that, you know, we often hear, I think, is this notion that in some cultures there are very strong gender roles and you know, very different expectations for how women and men should behave. And an extension of that often is that women are more conservative, and so talking about sex or sexuality is something that in some cultures it's much less comfortable. It's much more taboo for women to engage in that kind of talk, and we certainly think of our U.S. culture as being very kind of hypersexualized, and that would be uncomfortable or off-putting to someone, particularly a woman from a much more conservative culture. In my opinion, I would say that while that may be true, and I'll come back to that, that when we're talking about people who've been victimized and sexually assaulted, sexually abused, compelled into the sex industry, like many of the victims and survivors that we would be working with, those kind of sexual experiences are really difficult for anyone to talk about. No one is really comfortable talking about rape. No one is talking about, you know, that kind of forced, compelled sex, sexuality and sex acts. And then certainly, you know, whether you're from the U.S. or any other culture abroad, to be engaged in the sex industry where you are having multiple sexual encounters with multiple unknown individuals, that's not normal, really, sexual behavior in any culture. And I think that stigmatization is felt across the you know, the gamut. It doesn't matter if you're from the U.S. culture necessarily or the foreign national culture. I think most victims often feel that they have kind of crossed some line and that they've been engaging in a behavior that isn't, you know, quote unquote, normal. And so there often are feelings of shame, embarrassment, and a reluctance to talk about it. But there are certainly issues of modesty that do come up when you're working and serving particularly women, but men as well, from other cultures where there are stronger sort of restrictions and taboos, if you will, around personal modesty. And those are things that you probably can accommodate in a shelter or housing or residential center. And so thinking about you know, what kind of clothing people like to lounge around in, and whether you know, it's possible to make sure that you know, foreign national victims who want to be more covered have comfortable clothes to lounge around in that protect and respect their modesty, and maybe even, you know, thinking about you know, if they're moving back and forth to, you know, to bathe and moving, you know, what do people wear when they go from their bedroom to the shower areas? And maybe if people aren't able to have their own rooms, which is, you know, not common that everyone gets their own room in a shelter setting, but then making sure that there are private places where they can change their clothes, get ready for bathing so that they're not forced or you know, have options other than maybe changing in front of other individuals or worrying that someone might walk in when they're changing. And so even some small accommodations like that can be really helpful and make people feel more comfortable kind of in their downtime. The other thing that we've seen working with foreign national victims is the notion of talk therapy, especially in group settings, can be really uncomfortable, and that there certainly are issues that people don't like to talk about in particular, but in general, sometimes just talking about people's feelings, talking about your anxieties, your weaknesses for men or women, talking about emotions, talking about, you know, homesickness, those can be less comfortable for people who come from a culture where, you know, just they're socialized growing up. Like, don't talk about that. Don't show your emotions. You know, there certainly are cultures where there's a sort of private versus public, and the idea that you don't talk about feelings and weaknesses, you don't show emotion in public. And just recognizing that as a result, something like talk therapy, where you're talking with someone, or group therapy, where you're in public, if you will, can be really uncomfortable for some people, no matter what the topic is. And so what we've found works really well and seems to be appealing and comfortable are some of the more non-traditional therapies. And so art therapy, yoga and breathing exercises, other forms of relaxation techniques seem to work kind of better. And then also really thinking more about some of the kind of more crisis-oriented therapies, like teaching people coping techniques, you know, how to reframe if people are having intrusive thoughts or they're getting caught up in really negative thoughts, you know, helping them with tricks and tools to help reframe and to sort of change their internal narrative, breathing exercises to help de-escalate and sort of bring people's anxiety down, things that can actually be very personal and very internal and as a result kind of more private, can be more effective. And sometimes just the idea that they would even try something will make it more effective than some therapy that they don't even want to try, like maybe a group talk therapy. And so thinking about how to accommodate that if in your you know, shelter or in your residential setting, if you have group therapy, and just really thinking about, you know, is that really something that these this individual or these individuals would really feel comfortable engaging in? The other thing certainly is foods, and you know, I think that's a real simple, easy way to make people feel at home and comfortable is to really make an effort to have familiar foods available to them. Going on outings to ethnic markets and ethnic grocery stores can be a great opportunity to let the survivor kind of show you around and you know, pick out their own foods that they want to bring back, letting them take turns cooking so that they can share something positive from their culture with the other housemates or other residents. It's a way of not only feeling comforted, but also to share with others. And so food can be really great in that respect. Music also is another sort of an easy win, if you will. And so we... I worked with a shelter in Texas, and they would go online and find these video channels that have music from different countries, and you can find kind of music videos, live recordings of popular music from different countries, and then you know, the residents would share that with each other. And at this house in particular, they would take turns letting each resident pick the music for house cleaning day. And so when it was time to do the big chores, they would have a lot of music blaring to sort of keep everyone's mood up. They would take turns and let people play streaming from online different pop music from around the world. The other thing to really think about is people's spirituality and sort of the whole person. And so it can be really helpful to reconnect or connect individuals with their faith community, other practitioners of their same religion, and then, you know, sharing holidays, celebrating holidays with all of the other residents is, again, it's a great way to respect and let people feel comfortable in something familiar, but also give them the opportunity to share, again, something positive about themselves and their culture with the rest of the residents. And then I mentioned a little bit earlier about this sort of the common incident that people are often trafficked by people from their same home communities, and that can sometimes even include extended family members. And even in cases where that's not the case, family separation is really it's a huge issue for the foreign national victims, and so it can be really helpful to help reconnect and reestablish communication with, I would say, you know, certainly with the non-offending family members. And so it is important to have some understanding of who was complicit, who may have been involved in the trafficking, and be thoughtful about that. But for family members that were not in any way involved, certainly helping to reconnect, you know, buying phone cards is often a cheaper way than having international phone plans, for example. If you are concerned, though, about you know, whether someone was involved in the trafficking case, then monitoring phone calls may be necessary. And so I have sort of two points or two tips there. One is that regardless of who the family member is that your resident is talking to, you do want to do a little bit of education and a little monitoring early on. To make sure that they're not sharing information about, you know, where they're located, any kind of identifying information like that, that you just don't want them to inadvertently compromise the safety of themselves or any of your other residents, certainly. But then if you are a little bit concerned that maybe people were in some ways complicit in the trafficking, or if there's just some other unhealthy dynamics that I'll describe in a little more detail in a second, but you may want to monitor calls. And while it can be challenging if you don't speak the language of the individual, of your resident, then sometimes just sitting in, you know, not right on top of them, but being present and monitoring can be a good reminder for them to be careful that they're not inadvertently sharing information. And so you don't necessarily have to be understanding every word for word and then censoring, but rather just being sort of a reminder that they need to be cautious. The other thing is that, you know, some words are, you know, if they're giving an address, you'll recognize that. If, you know, I think if they're giving a phone number, you'll recognize that. So in some ways, you would probably recognize some of the most critical pieces of information regardless of the language. But again, to come back to just, you know, whether there's an unhealthy dynamic, you know, sometimes a family member may not have been complicit or in any way part of the trafficking scheme, but there can be other ways that people have unhealthy relationships. And one of the most common that we see with foreign national victims is this the pressure that the family in the home country places on the individual in your care to get back to work and help support the family, that there is such a pervasive, I don't want to say a myth, but in most parts of the world, people envision that in the U.S., everyone is more prosperous than they are in their home country. And so it's very hard for people in other countries to imagine that there isn't some way that the family member, your resident, can't be helping them financially somehow. And so they can put a lot of pressure on the individual through phone calls. And maybe what started out as just checking in and how's everyone doing can spiral down to a family member describing like, well, so-and-so is sick and needs medicine and we can't afford it. So-and-so needs to see a doctor, but we can't take them. We don't have the money. The kids are not in school because we can't pay the school fees. And so there can just be this pressure that begins to be placed on the individual in your care that can really set them back emotionally. Again, it can put that pressure on them to leave your program and look for some other work. Again, often back in that shadow economy. And so that's one reason that monitoring can be helpful. You can begin to see the person's, if they're beginning to look anxious, beginning to look distraught, then it may be time to sort of wrap up the call. But also it really helps to give people some prepping before a call with family. If you see this pattern that they are often unhappy after calls, then you need to sort of give them some outs and give them some tips before the call begins. And we often suggest that you give people a couple of sentences that they can use to pivot and redirect a conversation. So if you can tell your resident, tell the person you're caring for that, if your mom starts to talk about, what the family needs and unmet financial needs, then you need to say very clearly, I'm sorry to hear that, and then switch the conversation. Ask about an upcoming event. Ask about a specific family member. Highlight something positive happening in your own life. But just help them and prep them before the call starts to be prepared to pivot and change those conversations. And then also you just want to perhaps be ready to help them debrief and help them sort of address how they're feeling after the calls. And if you see this pattern of the calls, being a little bit stressful or a little depressing after the call is over, just be prepared for that and have something prepped for that post-phone call period, whether it's, and then we'll, get together with the group and start cooking dinner, or, and then you could have some quiet time in your room and, whatever works for that individual, but just be prepared to help kind of direct them to something that helps them with their anxiety. And this can even be in cases where there are no conflicts and where there isn't anything sort of negative about the phone conversation as much as just then the homesickness and the feeling of separation and the sadness that comes with being apart from family members. The other thing I just want to highlight that that I've seen work well or not well with the cases of the foreign national victims is that often there are these very complicated criminal investigations that are going on around their trafficking case. And I'm not sure if this happens as often with the U.S. citizen cases. But we do see that there, through the investigation and prosecution, there are a lot of periods where the prosecutors or the investigators need to come back to the client, since they're often the key witness, and ask more questions, look at photos. Sometimes other agencies get involved and then they want to have a deposition or an interview with your client. And as an advocate service provider, I know I'm always telling law enforcement that they need to be sensitive and considerate of the victims in these cases and do these interviews someplace comfortable, not in a interrogation or an interview room in a police station or in an immigration and customs enforcement office, for example. But I do think that it's really important that it not be in the individual's home. There's comfortable and then there's really a violation of their safe place. And so it's really critical, in my opinion, that interviews and anything related to the criminal case and the criminal investigation doesn't happen in the home, that that's not the place to have someone from law enforcement or attorney or whoever to come and talk through the criminal case with the individual. It's really important that that their homes be their sacred, safe, private space, and that that space be totally apart from their case. And that much like with phone calls, you as a care provider just want to be, this is probably obvious, but that you want to think about, if they're coming back from an interview, coming back from a deposition, coming back from a court hearing, that you are planning ahead and how to make the home base comfortable and welcoming when they get home from what can be a really stressful afternoon or day. So those are my tips on working with foreign national victims. I think that it's been always a pleasure of mine to work with the folks in the shelter and the residential programs. I think they have a real gift of creating safe, comfortable, happy spaces and environments for the residents in their care. And so I'm in awe that they are always, to carry a cell phone and sort of be on call, but the amount of sort of round the clock care that often folks working in those residential and shelter settings provide, I'm really in awe of that and grateful for the role that they play in the bigger care and restoration of the victims and survivors that we all work with. And I think that often that is one of the best and one of the most significant pieces of the restoration and the rebuilding of these folks and really helping them get back on their feet is the care that they get in these residential settings. And so if that's what you all do, then I'm grateful and I appreciate it. And we're certainly here at MRS, Migration Refugee Services, to help with case consultations and help connect with other resources for foreign national victims in particular. So thank you so much for this opportunity.
Thank you for listening. Learn how to subscribe to our Groundwork series by visiting our website at www.thesamaritanwomen.org.